the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. In a moment, we'll be talking with Faiza Patel from the Brennan Center on the Law at New York University. She's a law professor. She wrote an op-ed last week raising questions about the use of the term terrorism. And in particular, does it apply to the Charleston church shooting allegedly committed by Dylann Roof? And we widen out the conversation to talk about the creeping use of terrorism to justify exceptional law enforcement and judicial methods, some of which are unconstitutional. I think it's an important chat, and I hope you'll listen and let me know what you think about it. Before we begin, let me thank people who made this possible with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Kevin Beckley, Carl Harrison out there in Columbus, Ohio, Mona Kobus, and Anna H. Gordonier. They're all monthly subscribers, and I really appreciate their support. I invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the sign-up link. It's right under my picture on the homepage. Next page, you choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or a best deal, that $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers anywhere on the planet get a gift from me. It's the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's latest, called Empire of Chaos. Thanks for listening, and those of you who do support me, extra thanks to you from your humble host. Today on the Peter B. Collins Show, we're going to talk about the use of the term terrorism. When is it appropriate? And when is it used lazily or intentionally to mislead or mischaracterize a given event? Our opening music today I pulled from the Superman Unbound soundtrack. It's called Terrorist Attack. Because in some cases, the term terrorism is applied to events that really are based on fantasies, kind of like Superman. And there I'm referring to the FBI infiltration and entrapment methods that have been used in many Muslim communities across the United States. The other day I read an interesting commentary on these issues written by Faiza Patel. She is the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, which is at New York University's School of Law. And she knows her way around these issues. She's a member of the UN Human Rights Council's Working Group on the Use of Mercenaries. She also was a senior policy officer at the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons and clerked at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And she joins us today from New York. Faiza Patel, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, tell me your thoughts about the way that the term terrorism is applied in a broad sense, and then we'll focus on your commentary, which focused on whether or not it's appropriate in the Charleston church shooting case.
Well, so one of the things that we see in sort of post 9/11 America is that the word terrorism is used quite loosely, so that we have since 9/11, you know, broadened the definition of terrorism in ways that allow us to capture violence that is only very loosely affiliated with a particular ideology, as long as that ideology is in some way foreign, right? Mm-hmm. So you see, for example, you know, there have been a number of cases where you've got somebody who seems to be carrying out a kind of an ordinary act of violence, to the extent violence can ever be ordinary.
Right.
But that person may have been looking at internet videos of al-Awlaki, or looking at, you know, any kind of propaganda associated with al-Qaeda or ISIS, and we automatically kind of lump that in with the kind of terrorism that can be truly devastating and is directed from abroad, of the type that we saw in 9/11. And so we don't really distinguish between, you know, the different types of violence that we see.
Mm-hmm. And in your article, your commentary, you note that often the term terrorism is just reflexively applied to a crime mm-hmm. committed by a person who is identified as Muslim or even just as a kind of vaguely Arab, and that our media picks up on this and the headlines are trumpeted and the Fox News sounder goes off, you know, at full volume. Breaking news. And this ends up treating, you know, on one side, it trivializes true terrorism. And on another side, it conflates brutal crimes, which are certainly ugly and reprehensible, but that are not, in fact, terrorist events.
Well, and the other thing that it does, right, is that when you sort of trumpet ordinary violence as being terrorism, you raise the profile of the threat. So you continue to have this feeling of insecurity in society, and you continue to emphasize the threat from, you know, one particular quarter. So if you go back to July 4th weekend, right, so suddenly, you know, CNN was broadcasting, oh my God, federal officials are saying that there's going to be attacks across the United States on July 4th weekend, right? I mean, this was put out there, even though the feds were saying, you know, we have no specific threats, we have no specific information about an attack. And then this all becomes part of this kind of ambient scaring the population tactic, which seems to be, you know, quite common. And the same way, when you have a kind of normal sort of violent crime, which may have lots of different motivations behind it, but you put it as part of this overarching Islamist, Al-Qaeda, ISIS terrorism, you continue to raise the fear that people feel from those organizations, but also more broadly from their fellow citizens who are Muslim or Arab or Asian.
And you referenced the 4th of July weekend and the warnings that preceded it. We also have the FBI director, Too Tall Jim Comey, testifying before Congress that the FBI busted up 10 events over that weekend. We have zero evidence that this is true. We have no public reporting of events that surfaced or people who were arrested. He vaguely referred to some recent domestic terrorism arrests that the FBI has conducted and gotten headlines for, but he didn't offer any proof, and nobody asked him for any proof, which is
right.
Even more astounding.
Well, and the reality is, I mean, if there were really 10 serious terrorism events, as he calls them, in the United States over the July 4th weekend, wow, I'd really like to know, right? I mean, that would be a major story, one that they should be covering, you know, 24/7. But we don't, as you say, we have no information about what was there, so it's really hard to say what those events were or how serious they actually were.
Now, Faiza Patel, in your op-ed piece that people can read at justsecurity.org, and a little later I want to talk to you about that service that you provide from the Brennan Center, but you wrote that after the Charleston shooting, the FBI director said that, well, these actions weren't technically terrorism, and in this case, he seems to be splitting hairs to avoid calling a right-wing white American who guns down a group of African Americans a mass criminal or a mass killer, but unwilling to call that terrorism. Do you think that Dylann Roof committed an act of terrorism?
I think that so here's the thing, right? We call a lot of things terrorism that we don't actually charge as terrorism. So if you go back and you look at, you know, the DOJ, for example, has long put out this list of successful terrorism-related prosecutions. I mean, that's going to cover the gamut of something that really is a terrorism prosecution to somebody who's deported on immigration charges. So it's really a question of what we as a society kind of put in the category of terrorism and that we recognize as requiring a kind of a broader response. And I think that's the point that I was trying to make, which is that, you know, we tend to, when it's violence directed at minority populations, there's a real tendency to say, oh, this is just a one-off, oh, this is just a crazy guy, and very little thought given to thinking about, well, is this part of a broader pattern? Whereas when it's the opposite, when you have any kind of minority committing a crime or an act of terror, well, then it's, you know, all Muslims are terrorists, or all blacks are criminals, or all Latinos are, you know, immigration law busters. So things like that, these kinds of sort of broad generalizations that we give to minority communities, whereas when it's a majority community, that's where the offense is coming from. We just don't want to recognize any patterns at all.
And I do want to just recall something I said a moment ago. I suggested that Dylann Roof is flatly the shooter. He is charged with the crime, and the surveillance video certainly places him there, and the surviving witnesses place him there. But he has not been convicted yet, and I just want to amend what I said, because he is still the alleged shooter in this case. Now, let me turn to another example. James Holmes' attorneys have admitted that he was the shooter at the Batman movie premiere in Aurora, Colorado. And you would not call that an act of terrorism. There doesn't appear to be any political component to that in any way that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, we attribute greater danger and greater importance to violence when it is linked to some kind of ideology, whether it's a right-wing, you know, white supremacist sovereign nation type of ideology, or whether it's an extreme environmental ideology or an al-Qaeda type ideology. So as a society, we treat those as being in a separate category than the kind of mass shootings that we've seen sadly in so many places over the last several years, which we leave random violence separately, I guess.
And the point I want to make here is, and you actually make this point with statistics, that since 9/11, right-wing violence, mostly white gunmen, have killed 254 people in the United States, while terrorism plots connected to Muslims account for about one-fifth of that, about 50 fatalities. And we have this report, I believe it was 2009, published by the Department of Homeland Security, saying that the greatest domestic risk comes from fringe white and right-wing radical groups in this country. And yet we seem to be allergic to labeling them as they are, and yet we have this whole pushback from the right wing that criticizes President Obama for failing to define ISIS as an ideology, a Muslim-driven terrorist group. So I find these inconsistencies very interesting.
Well, I mean, there's definitely a whiff of a double standard here, right? I mean, that report that you mentioned, which came out of DHS in 2009, was frankly suppressed, right? The department got a huge amount of criticism for putting out this report, and a lot of people in Congress and in policymaking circles on the conservative side of the spectrum were outraged by the thought that, you know, the right-wing ideology could be considered a threat. And so they just shot that down. And now, of course, we have a kind of resurgence of interest in this issue. But I do want to add a word of caution here, which is I think that just as I think that we shouldn't focus too much on ideology when we're talking about ISIS or Al-Qaeda, but should really be looking at kind of what are the particular regional and political and power dynamics that are at play. Similarly, you know, I don't think that you can draw a straight line from racist ideology as being a predictor for someone who's going to, you know, be the next Charleston shooter. So I think we have to be very careful as a society, no matter what ideology we're talking about, no matter how repugnant we find it, that we are calibrated in our response so that we actually focus on those who are violent or you're about to commit violence rather than trying to crack down on thoughts that we find offensive.
Well, I fully agree with you, and I would expand on your remarks, Faiza Patel, because I think that we have seen opportunistic use of the term terrorism and the whole idea of it as a reason for massive response, for denial of fundamental elements of the Bill of Rights to American citizens on a dragnet massive scale. And we know, for example, that the NSA's 215 program, the collection of everyone's telephone records, has not busted up any significant terrorist plots. The government admits that. Also, the lone wolf clause that Mitch McConnell said if it wasn't renewed over the Memorial Day weekend was going to leave America vulnerable to attacks. It's never been used. The roving wiretaps portion of that law that they said had to be reinstated to protect Americans has never been used in a significant terrorism prosecution that we know of. And so we have to balance the intentional use of this term as a way to escalate a police state structure in the United States and what I call the vertical integration of law enforcement, where we now have federal officials who have expanded powers, like the national security letters that an FBI agent can essentially write his or her own warrant without even asking a judge for permission. And these are used, and the term terrorism is invoked on First Amendment groups who are protesting against prairie dogs or the Keystone XL pipeline. And so we have a creeping police state that is fueled by the abuse or intentional misuse of the term terrorism.
No, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, and if you kind of go back to history a little bit and you look at sort of the threat of communism and the fear of communism and everything that we as a society did to combat that perceived threat, you know, one of the things that came out of that was, you know, massive abuses of surveillance authorities. We had, you know, J. Edgar Hoover and all of his shenanigans. And back in the 1970s, you know, Congress sort of kind of woke up to this, and the American people woke up to this, and we put into place a set of reforms, which are really meant to constrain the intelligence community so that, you know, they wouldn't start looking at people or harassing people unless there was some indication that they were involved in some kind of wrongdoing. And that's been sort of the bedrock principle since the 1970s, which has been in many of our laws and regulations and policies and has been being steadily undermined, and certainly after 9/11, that whole premise almost sort of, you know, vanishes out of our legal structures, and that's been, I think, one of the biggest things that's happened since 9/11, which is this opening of the door to domestic intelligence gathering of various kinds, which can so easily bleed over into basically suppressing dissent.
Well, and Faiza Patel, I'm glad you mentioned Hoover and COINTELPRO and the excesses of that era. I was a young radio talk show host in Chicago at that time, and I covered the trial that was brought by the survivors of Fred Hampton following the police killings of that Black Panther leader and some of his colleagues. And as a result, I became a target. There was a file on me in the FBI headquarters in Washington that I later retrieved under the Freedom of Information Act. And so I'm very sensitive to, you know, these kinds of activities that go well out of the bounds of law enforcement and go into infiltration and agents provocateur. And Trevor Aronson is, I think, a talented reporter. And in his book, he disclosed that out of some 515 so-called domestic terrorism prosecutions, somewhere around 1% were completely untainted by a paid informant, by the FBI agent providing the means or even the idea for a crime that a person was then convicted for conspiring to achieve. And so Aronson has reported that the FBI has 15,000 paid informants circulating in the United States, many targeting Muslim communities. And then we see these claims of, a guy in New Jersey or New York who wanted to join the Islamic State, and the FBI bought him the plane ticket that they used to bust him for his intent to go to Syria. And so with these levels of entrapment going on, it makes me very skeptical whenever I see the term terrorism applied.
Yeah, and the sad part is, that real terrorism is in fact a scary thing. And as you said, sort of right at the beginning, to have everything be conflated and put things that are not like each other in the same box and treat them the same way is what's really frustrating about what's going on now. And also, frankly, leaving aside sort of the civil liberties concerns, which we all have, there's also the question about, is it effective? Is the FBI actually making us any safer by spending its time and resources going after, these loser dudes who are, don't seem like they're likely to do anything without a little help from the government, or a lot of help from the government, actually. So I think there's also a big question in my mind about effectiveness.
Well, and over the weekend, I want to credit Murtaza Hussein, who writes at The Intercept, for an interesting profile of the son of Edward Said, Wadi Said, who is an attorney who's been active in defending those accused of domestic terrorism. And Said has a new book out. I've got to get it. Have you had a chance to read Crimes of Terror?
No, but I know often, and actually I'd been in touch with him over email to come and give us a book talk. And I was always a great admirer of his father, obviously. So
indeed. So what he says, and I'm quoting from the article here, since 9/11, the U.S. government has pursued extraordinary legal as well as extra-legal efforts to combat terrorism, and in doing so has expanded the terrorist label far beyond its previous connotations. Said argues that measures taken by the courts have created an effective terrorist exception to previously existing legal standards, including the use of evidence or testimony derived from torture, testimony provided by a disguised individual who is actually a Mossad agent in one case, where he was permitted to testify that he could smell Hamas on a defendant's charity work. And these are people who went to the government and said, what is the legal way to give cash or aid to people in Gaza? And they got no response. And then they were convicted of material support to a terrorist group when they went out of their way to avoid getting caught up in the, the fact that Hamas has been labeled a terrorist group. So this is a very important issue to me. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on Said and this kind of exceptionalism where the courts have become so deferential to prosecutors just because they use certain buzzwords.
Well, as I said, I haven't read his book, so I can't comment on exactly what he's saying. But in terms of there being a kind of a special treatment for terrorism in U.S. courts, I think you have to look at two things. So one is that the laws have changed as well. So, normally you think that if somebody, in order for somebody to commit a crime, particularly if it's a serious crime, there has to be some kind of intent, right? You have to intend to kill somebody and then you get convicted for murder. And the same thing applies generally with sort of terrorism crimes, like, which is you have to intend to carry out a terrorist act. But one of the things that happened since 9/11 is that we have these so-called material support laws, which basically allow for conviction of material support for terrorism, even when there is no intent to support a terrorist cause. So if I'm sending money to Gaza because I want to help Palestinian children, and that money lands up in Hamas's coffers some way or the other, but doesn't really matter for purposes of the law as it's been written, because the main thing is just what happens, not what I intended to happen. So that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is that, so you already have, you know, a kind of a loaded deck, right? And then courts, and this has been true throughout our history, are always very deferential to the government in times of national security crises, right? I mean, we can go back to the Korematsu case in which the Supreme Court validated the internment of Japanese Americans, all the way through to some of the cases, you know, involving some of the espionage cases earlier in our history. So whenever there is a strongly perceived security risk, courts tend to be very deferential to the government.
But that's no excuse.
Since 9/11, that's been the case. But, I mean, I actually think that I feel like I have a little bit of cause of hope now, which is that I think that it's been long enough and that courts have been seeing these kinds of mantras repeated again and again, and we start to see at least a few signs of courts pushing back and questioning them. So the case of the Newburgh Four, which was another one of these FBI informant cases, mm-hmm. you know, the judge was actually quite clear and said something to the effect of, you know, this would not have been a case if the government hadn't intervened, right? So there's definitely, I think, a small but growing recognition among the courts that maybe they should look a little more closely at the government's claims.
But material support is a very murky legal concept, and the courts have rightfully thrown it out in terms of the way it was applied to prisoners at Guantanamo who were convicted of material support when it had not been enacted as an offense. and therefore, those particular convictions were thrown out. But we saw in the phony reform of the USA Freedom Act, which simply transferred the possession of our phone records, not the ability of the government to collect or look at them, really. And in there was embedded a harsher sentence for material support.
From 15 to 20.
Yeah. Yep. And there's been very little commentary on that. Even the progressives, who opposed that bill for the right reasons, rarely made that argument. And you know, this is one of the flimsiest bases that has been used since 9/11 to either, approach people or threaten them or actually convict them. And I don't think it has any place. There's certainly plenty of laws that can be used to prosecute real crime. But this has been used far too often to allow entrapment. And this is a very slippery slope, and we've slid pretty far down it.
Yep, I couldn't agree with you more.
So one other aspect that I wanted to raise, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with this case, but Kevin Gostola at Fire Dog Lake last week reported on a case that is currently before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it's Panagakis versus Towery. And Towery is a former member of the U.S. Army Force Protection Division at Fort Lewis McChord in Washington State, and he was ordered by his superiors to infiltrate First Amendment protest groups who coalesced around some of the troop movements from Fort Lewis during the Iraq War. And this was in the period of 2006 to 2009. Now, the case is under seal, and that, to begin with, is quite troubling. But here we have a case that appears to violate posse comitatus, where mm-hmm. the U.S. military was used as a domestic spying apparatus. And again, these are First Amendment activists. There is no indication whatsoever that these people had any any even, you know, strained relationship like material support to terrorist intentions. And yet this case is moving forward on appeal, and it is sealed from public view. And I think that the elements that are visible are quite troubling.
Yeah, and I think it sort of highlights another problem, you know, with the sort of post 9/11 world that we live in, which is this kind of rather poisonous secrecy that we operate under. And, you know, I sort of am of the view that in a democracy, the way it should work is that the government should come and gather information about its citizens to the minimum extent necessary, you know, to make sure that it can keep the country secure, but that the government itself should be as transparent about its activities as possible. And what we've seen over the last decade and a half is an absolute flipping of that paradigm. So the government is collecting vast amounts of information on us and telling us very little about what it's doing in our name. And I think that's really damaging to democracy. And one of the things that we've seen is this increasing secrecy in court proceedings as well. I mean, in the wake of Edward Snowden, you know, the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, became a big topic of conversation. This court has operated since 1978. And until Snowden, only three of its decisions were ever made public. And now we have a much larger handful, maybe 12, 15 or so. But, you know, here you had a court that was just operating entirely in secret. And we see more and more of these closed proceedings in terrorism cases, sealed cases, you know, the government being quite mysterious about the sources from which it acquired information and evidence. So it really is quite a difficult issue across the system.
There's also, I think in legal terms, it's called ex parte, when one side of a dispute is able to talk privately with a judge and the defense, or a plaintiff in some cases, is completely kept out of it. And we had this most bizarre proceeding here in San Francisco, Dr. Patel, which was the Al Haramain case, where the attorneys accidentally got proof that they had been wiretapped by the FBI. And as they pursued their case, they actually won money damages from the government. And it was Judge Vaughn Walker who found in favor of the plaintiffs. But John Eisenberg, the attorney, told me about this bizarre story where he went to the federal courthouse in San Francisco, and he was allowed to go into a room where he could use a government computer to write up arguments that were in response to government arguments that he had not seen. And so he had to shoot in the dark. If the government argues that, you know, this is the case, my response would be that. But he was not allowed to see that the arguments that the government had made, to which he was responding. And at the end of that session, everything was shredded. and that is such a Kafkaesque proceeding, to be just completely un-American and an affront to our claim to be a nation of laws, you know, where justice prevails.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, you do see these kinds of situations happening, you know, occasionally in the courts, where national security really kind of shuts everything else down. So, you know, take, for example, all of the cases that were filed relating to the rendition of people to other countries for torture. And the government simply came in and said, you know, this is a state secret. Now, traditionally, state secrets was an evidentiary privilege, which meant that you could use it to exclude certain pieces of evidence, saying, you know, this would reveal a state secret. But since the Bush administration and through the Obama administration, it is instead used to shut down entire cases. And what that means is that not only does the public not get to know what actually happened in their name, but that there's no accountability, right? And that has really, I think, been one of the hallmarks of this this era, because secrecy often goes together with a lack of accountability.
And
it all hush-hush, nobody gets punished.
You just referenced the Jeppesen Aviation case, which was thrown out because of a state secrets assertion brought by the Obama administration. And this was in February of 2009, and the justices on the panel were incredulous. And they asked the U.S. attorneys who were making this presentation, has this been cleared with the new administration? They could not believe it. And we knew that Jeppesen was the contractor that ran the so-called torture taxis, these corporate jets that were leased to ferry these kidnapped prisoners around. We knew that Binyam Mohammed, the plaintiff in the case, was subjected to that type of treatment. And there was so much that was out in the open. And yet we were told we must pretend that this information we have can now be declared secret. I mean, that's just... this fundamentally insulting.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, they say secrecy is the worm that eats the heart of democracy. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, Faiza Patel, thank you for joining me today. It's a pleasure to meet you and talk about these issues. Take a moment to talk about your work at the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center at NYU, and in particular, the Just Security blog. And I subscribe to your newsletter every day, so I get highlights of what's going on at the blog.
So the Brennan Center and the blog are slightly different, although both are at NYU. So at the Brennan Center, I, along with my colleague, head up a program called Liberty and National Security, and our main focus is to ensure that the policies and laws that are put in place to counterterrorism are both effective, but also respectful of our constitutional values and of the rule of law more broadly. And I've worked primarily in the counterterrorism and surveillance space, and that those are the issues that I deal with the most, sort of ranging from, you know, surveillance of particular communities, such as Muslims, by the NYPD, all the way through some of the work that's come out of Edward Snowden's disclosures, which have certainly, you know, put a spotlight on privacy in ways that we didn't see 3 years ago. And so that's sort of the focus of my work. And then the Just Security blog is actually a very great thing, and I encourage everyone to subscribe to it. It's also at NYU, run by a professor at NYU, Ryan Goodman, and another professor up at American College of Law at Washington, Steve Laddick, both huge experts in different fields of law, and then give you a curated roundup of the day's national security news stories, as well as blogs written both by folks who are on his board of editors like myself, but also a number of interesting guest bloggers from sort of across the political and professional spectrum who are thinking and talking about these issues. So it's good fun to look at every morning.
All right. Well, I certainly recommend it. The web address is justsecurity.org. I'll include a link in the show file for this podcast so you can click on it and get right over there. And my thanks to Faiza Patel for joining me today. Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview. I welcome your comments and feedback. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.